So, some of the themes that we're going to look at today are, what is faith in Zen, in Buddhism? Do I have it? Do I need it? How does faith differ from belief? What is the faith in? What is true entrusting when we entrust ourselves to the Dharma, or we entrust ourselves to Amida's compassion, to the Nembutsu? How does this practice, how does faith relate to our practice on the cushion, to shikantaza, to koans, to the listening, the practice of listening? That's one of the central practices of Shin, Pure Land Buddhism, to prayer, to non-doing, the effortless effort that we make, and to non-thinking. And also interwoven with these questions are, we will look at Buddha nature. Buddha nature is original perfection in one way. It's the perfection of things as they are. And part of, and this topic, I think, actually ends up relating closely to faith and to true nature, to the nature of enlightenment itself. So I'm going to start with some bits from a book called How to Raise an Ox, Zen Practice as Taught in Master Dogen's Shobo Genzo. Dogen, as you may know, is the founder of our Japanese Soto Zen school. He's often regarded as a literary genius, a religious genius, very kind of endlessly subtle. This particular book by Francis Dogen Cook contains translations of pieces of Dogen's masterwork, the Shobo Genzo, and also contains essays preceding each translation. And the essays in this book are particularly brilliant, and they make Dogen, who's very difficult to read, make a much more easily grasped, though still subtle, sense. So many of these excerpts are going to be from Francis Cook's essays. So one of the things that Cook says about faith is that when meditators begin to verify the teachings of the Buddha in their own experience, faith is superseded by direct knowledge. So this is how he opens the chapter in which he's going to be talking about Dogen's view on faith. And this is this points to one of the tenets that's especially emphasized in Zen. One of the things that Buddha said is, come and taste it for yourself. You don't have to believe anything. And so this is what you don't need. You don't need belief, but eventually your direct knowledge becomes the object of your faith. Buddhist faith is a deep certitude as to the veracity of a certain doctrine, accepted and used as a touchstone for a conduit in confidence that one's practice will verify its truth. So in this view of Zen, the faith is used as a provisional tool for yourself until you've verified these things for yourself. Faith is further strengthened by one's association with people who actualize their own experiential knowledge in their lives. So when we take refuge in the Buddha or the Dharma, part of the value of these spiritual traditions are the spiritual teachers, the lineage of teachers, the people who have started in exactly the same confused, suffering place that we are, and with these very teachings have verified them for themselves, have replaced provisional acceptance with true faith in them. So, Buddha said, the ocean of the Buddha's teaching is entered through the door of faith. And for Dogen, practice is based on faith that one already is a Buddha, for there is nothing that is not Buddha. Grass, trees, all are one mind and body, says Dogen. If all dharmas are marked with this ultimate reality, then even a speck of dust is marked with it. The one mind is all dharmas. All dharmas are the one mind, the whole body. And here's a Dogen excerpt. Practicing the way of the Buddha means you must have faith in the Buddha way. Having faith in the Buddha way means you must first have faith that you originally abide in the way, are not deluded, are not mistaken, neither gain nor lose in Buddha wisdom, and are not in error. If you arouse this kind of faith, illuminate the way in this manner and rely on it and practice it, this is the basis for enlightenment. That sounds like a tall order, doesn't it? And yet, and so we might you know, feel we don't have that faith. We don't have confidence in our correct practice. We may not have the belief that we're Buddha, and in fact, that belief may be a hindrance. One of the things that's different between faiths and beliefs, I read a really, I don't remember where I came across it, but belief clings, faith lets go. Nothing about the Buddha way is about anything as small as our beliefs. Dogen also says, to have faith in the Buddha and his teaching and to commit oneself to hard practice without reservation is atonement. So we begin our liturgy with atonement, with an expression of faith. Taking refuge in the three treasures means relying on Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and not on one's own abilities, so that taking refuge then is itself a statement of faith in their reality and power. Isn't that interesting? This is the even in the Zen perspective, we can't rely on our own power, even in the self power school. Dogen, yes. Taking refuge in the three treasures means relying completely on Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and not on one's own abilities, so that taking refuge in them is itself a statement of faith in their reality and power. Dogen goes on to say, with regard to taking refuge in the three treasures, with pure faith in your abdomen, the location of faith is in your abdomen, whether the Tathagata dwells in the world or does not, join the palms of your hands together, bow your head and say, I, from now until I become a Buddha, take refuge in the Buddha, take refuge in the teaching, take refuge in the community of followers. And yet, the realm of Buddhas is inconceivable and beyond the reach of intellect. How can it be reached by someone who has no faith, who has little knowledge? Again, this is Dogen speaking of the importance of faith. So, a while ago we talked about Shin Buddhism, which is a practice of pure faith, a practice that doesn't require, it's a school that doesn't require the hard practice that Dogen points to, It isn't the way of the sages. It isn't the saintly way. It's the easy way. Shin is simply entrusting to the boundless compassion of the universe. And so I'm going to read a little bit of some summaries about some pithy bits about the Shin path. These are written by Mark Uno, who is one of the most interesting Shin teachers in English. The name of Amida Buddha. In the Meditation Sutra, it is stated that for those who are unable to achieve the meditative visualization of the Pure Land, so traditionally in old Chinese Pure Land Buddhism, there's a sutra that explains in great detail what the Pure Land looks like. And part of Pure Land practice in China was visualizing it in meticulous, powerful detail so that it became very real to you. Achieve the meditative visualization of the Pure Land, the recitative invocation of Amitabha's name, and Amitabha and Amitayus are the two are names of the Buddha that were contracted into Amida in Japanese, is sufficient to attain birth in the Pure Land. Meditative visualization. In China and especially Japan, this becomes the most widespread form of practice known as the Denbutsu, which becomes just the repetition of the name, Namu Amida Butsu, which means I take refuge in an Amida Buddha. This is the very manifestation of Amida. Philosophically, to take refuge in Amida Buddha is to abandon ego-centered, attached thinking and to entrust oneself to the infinite wisdom and infinite compassion of Amida. Since the ultimate body, or Dharmakaya, of Amida is formless, one attains formless reality through the name. The invocation is itself the thing. It is itself the transformative act. Shinran is the founder of the Jodo Shinshu sect, which Shinran is particularly appealing to me because the place at which he began to become an important teacher was when he realized he was utterly incapable of all religious practice. Shinran abandoned the ritual observance of all these practices of recitation, of visualization at the age of 43 and turned his attention solely to the Nembutsu. His conclusion was that no matter how skillful he may have appeared outwardly, inwardly it was impossible to become free from thoughts of attachment, conceit, and insecurity. And of course we can all relate to that. You know, satisfying our meditation is at its best, that passes. The failure of this self-effort or self-power opened up the realm of other power, the formless reality of the highest truth taking shape in the wisdom and compassion of boundless light. Amida Buddha embodied in the name. The two ideas of self-power and other power are complementary. Without seeing the one, the other cannot be seen. They are like the clouds and the sun that shines through them. So again, just as we saw in Dogen, this setting up of faith or verification of self-power or other power, both of those are kind of half the story. And impossible without the other one. They include the other one. Shinran emphasized the simultaneous awareness of foolishness and the awareness of boundless compassion. And so in the practice of saying the Nembutsu, which is not a practice because you don't do it for anything, it doesn't do anything at all, and yet we do it anyhow if we do it. The Namu is the acknowledgement of our foolishness, and the Amida Butsu, Amida Buddha, is the expression of the boundless compassion. It's giving ourselves over to the compassion of Amida, the compassion of the universe. The term for this is Shinjin, which is often rendered as true and trusting, a letting go of all attachments which enables the natural unfolding of compassion and wisdom. Shinran also says, in the Nembutsu, in the recitation of the name, no meaning is the true meaning. Isn't that interesting? And that starts to sound a little bit like Zen. It sounds like Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma's resounding, I don't know, in response to the emperor's question, who is this person before me? What merit do I gain? No merit, no meaning. Shinran cautions, if you talk about this too much, then no meaning will appear to have some special kind of meaning. So I'm going to read you a couple more expressions of faith in Shin Buddhism. Renyo Shonin, the eighth head priest of the Jodo Shinshu lineage of Pure Land Buddhism, taught that we should not recite the Nembutsu in order to be saved, but because we are saved. And this this kind of points us back to Buddha nature in Zen. We don't practice to attain Buddha nature. We don't practice to become a Buddha. We practice because we are Buddha nature. We are nothing but Buddha nature. We are already manifesting the boundless mind and body of Buddha. In Zen, this is expressed. There's a koan, a teaching story in which master comes upon a student saying and meditating, and master says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm trying to become a Buddha." And then the master picks up a roof tile and starts polishing it, and the student says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm making a mirror." It's just as foolish to try to become Buddha as to convert a ceramic roof tile into a mirror. Mark Uno also gives us a very interesting presentation of Shikantaza, which is the practice of just sitting, or sitting only, is another way of translating it. And he has this to say, the only of sitting only signifies not to or non-duality and stands in contrast to dualistic thinking, which is based on some finite, limited, or objectified goal. Sitting only focuses one's attention on becoming one with the present moment, and we would the activity at hand as a manifestation of the all-embracing Buddha nature, which transcends all dichotomies. In this sense, the only of sitting only is to be manifest whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, that is, at all times. So even our practice of Shikantaza is a non-practice in a different but related way that the Nembutsu of Shin is a non-practice. It's not for anything. It isn't doing anything. I'm going to read you a couple of pieces from an excellent book called One Dharma by Joseph Goldstein. He has this to say about faith. Faith, devotion, and confidence are all translations of the Pali word sadha. All these terms refer to the feeling that opens the mind and heart to what is beyond our usual ego concerns and desires. Sadha opens up us to what is greater than ourselves, to the possibility of freedom. Faith becomes both our initial inspiration to practice and explore, and what sustains our continuing effort. So there's a way in which our very sitting here is an expression of our faith. And it's if we ever sit a second period of zazen, if we ever sit through a period of zazen with pain in the neck or knees, if we ever sit some minutes of zazen when there's anything else that we can do, what is it that draws us to it? What is it about that? We have a sense that there's something in it that's real. There's something in it that's valuable. There's something in it that you see for yourself. Even if it is some kind of shadowy awareness that you can't put into words, perhaps that's even, you know, a clearer perception. But the thing that keeps us coming back to zazen, and the thing that is our connection to this larger than us, and it's our faith in that that brings us back, each in our own way, to the Sangha, to the cushion. And our verification that there is something about practice that is, in fact, related to this intimate, specific moment of our body and mind. We see some of this. Sometimes it fades from view. Sometimes it's clouded by judgments or belief that this can't be it, that this isn't it, that we have no Buddha nature, this is nirvana, whatever, but, you know, this really just totally sucks, and that's the entirety of it. But even then, there is something that kind of holds us, and that's our larger self, our wiser self connecting to, I don't know, something. Relatedly, faith also arises from our growing awareness of suffering. Faced with distress, we may go in one of two directions. We can fall prey to bewilderment, doubt, and further confusion, or we can begin to seek a way of understanding and release. There is suffering that leads to more suffering, and suffering that leads to its end. In times of great pain, we often drown in our feelings of despair and anger or hopelessness, but it's also possible for that suffering to awaken profound faith in new possibilities, to provoke an intense interest and investigation. We can ask, what is going on? What is this? How can I understand this? How can this guide me out of suffering? And this is the shift that takes place when, like that I was describing today with my anxiety. So when not paying attention, you know, the anxiety becomes opaque. It becomes kind of world-filling. It becomes the only thing to see. And yet, having cultivated the mind of kind of meditative inquiry, I was able to get a little bit of space to go, okay, what is this? And then through that crack, it opened up. And there's and I personally take great solace in the fact that there is no experience, however terrifying, unpleasant, painful, sad, traumatic, that I can endure, that can happen to me, that I can't in that moment be free with. And and this is why I think I can honestly say that I'm not actually afraid of my own death. I'm not afraid of the process of dying, so far as I know, or so far as I believe. But the thing is that anything, you know, whether it's the death of my father, the illness of my mother, the dissolution of a marriage, the failure of this body, the dark and painful psychological states that my mind is prone to, like, all of those are things that I can hold intimately, that I can investigate and find cracks in that open to the larger boundlessness that contains and pervades them. I don't know if that was coherent, but maybe it was radiant to the heart. Deep, compelling faith arises when we glimpse the possibility of freedom. And so in some moment of zazen, when, or in an interview, or in some thing in your life, when you see clearly for the first time the possibility of freedom, that gives rise to this whole other, like, realization of faith, the faith that will sustain you in any suffering, any trauma. This is the transformative moment when we go from an intellectual appreciation of the Dharma to the faith and confidence that awakening is possible, that we ourselves can do this. And we begin to have confidence in the moment, in the actuality of experience. And so when the moment itself becomes an object of faith, then faith isn't in the category of, well, do I have it or not? Am I really believing in something that's real or not? Then it's just the moment itself. And you can't really doubt the fact of a moment, the fact of your being, the fact of the universe's being. Joseph Goldstein says, belief draws conclusions while faith flowers in openness, which is another version of belief clings and faith lets go. He also talks of one of his first experiences of faith. I experienced the very pragmatic benefits of faith even in the early years of my meditation practice. I was spending my days alternating sitting and walking meditation, and during times of boredom, frustration, depression, or whatever the difficulty might have been, I often reminded myself, just surrender to the Dharma. Your job is simply to sit and walk. Sit and walk. Let the Dharma take care of the rest. This surrender to the Dharma, the faith in practice, kept inspiring me to continue. So one of the practices in Shin is listening. Just listening, letting the sounds of the world itself call you to the world itself, letting the sounds come in, not going out after them. Dogen says when the self advances to meet the 10,000 things, that's delusion. When the 10,000 things advance and confirm the self, that's enlightenment. And this is a description of this kind of listening practice. An interviewer asked Mother Teresa what she says to God when she prays. I don't say anything, she replies. I just listen. So the interviewer asked her what God says to her. He doesn't say anything, says said Mother Teresa. He just listens. And then before the astonished interviewer could press her further, she added, "And if you don't understand that, I can't explain it to you." I love that. One of the books that I'm working on at work now, actually I just finished up with it, which is always very sad for me. It's like at the end of a project, I always am quite satisfied with it. It's so beautiful. It's so whatever. It's really polished often, and then I need to let it go and begin work on something that I'm just aghast with. Such a mess, and this just happens over and over again. And I don't get to hold on to my past success. It's really a great Dharma practice of this impermanence. But the book that I have recently just wrapped up work on that I really enjoyed is called Christian Insight Meditation, which is a very, very Christian book. It's a straight-up Christian book, and it's completely Buddhist. She explores... it's kind of like a manual for following in the footsteps of John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, who are two of Christianity's great mystics. And the means by which we do that, it turns out, can be Buddhist practice. And so this book talks of prayer, which is not something that we talk of in Buddhism or in Zen, especially. And yet, you know, there's something in our hearts that kind of pulls us to prayer, maybe, some of us, or, you know, one of the things about, that the more I practice Zen, the more affinity I find with God language. I used to be very opposed to it, but, like, it seems to be increasingly a quite clear expression of my experience of the Dharma. So Teresa of Avila defined prayer as intimate sharing between friends. It means frequently taking the time to be alone with God, who we know loves us. And there's much about the way Teresa of Avila talks about God that sounds so much like Shin practice to me. Fundamental to this prayer is the faith conviction that God dwells in the depths of our hearts. And this is for me another way of clearly expressing that we are Buddha nature, that we are, that this, just as it is original perfection, which for me isn't an article of belief, but it's something to be seen, verified. So the conviction that God dwells in the depths of our hearts, it is there that we seek God. Consider that St. Augustine sought God in many places, but found him ultimately within himself. Do you think it doesn't matter for someone with a wandering mind to understand this truth, says Augustine, and to see that we need not go to heaven and speak with or delight in our eternal Father? All we need do is go in solitude and look at him within ourselves. And then the author of this book says, Teresa was quite clear, however, that attention to God within might not necessarily be consoling or pleasurable. The silent, loving look at Christ may take place in dryness and aridity. We could experience God's presence as absence, we might find it difficult to still our restless mind. The attitude of faith and love we bring to prayer is essential. So sometimes our zazen isn't pleasant. Sometimes the very texture of our liberation is the heart pounding in our ears, is the cycling fears of anxiety. Sometimes we experience God's presence as absence. Sometimes we experience our Buddha nature as a deep, deep conviction that we can't possibly be expressing Buddha nature right now. That's what the Buddha nature right now feels like. God is both intimately close to us, yet beyond all we can think, feel, or conceive. That is why we can never judge God's presence or absence in our lives by our feelings or whatever beautiful thoughts we might or might not have about God. We can't judge our zazen, our shikantaza, our nembutsu by whatever pleasant or unpleasant feelings we may have, by whatever spiritual sense we may or may not have, by any mere content of our life, not the mere content of our minds, not the mere content of any moment, not the mere circumstances of our life. In prayer, we let go of our desire to do something, to feel God's presence, to make subtle reflections about God, and to control our relationship with God. Instead, John of the Cross instructed us to become non-doing, passive, and tranquil in God's presence. So this is John of the Cross describing sitting only. We can, knowledge of God, regarding knowledge of God, we can neither earn it nor attain it through our natural faculties of knowing, loving, or acting. We receive it passively. And this sounds like Amita's compassion to me. And this is why the practices in Shin are non-practices, because you can't earn it. You can't attain it. Prayer, according to John, invites us to surrender our cravings for self-gratifying experiences, lay aside our compulsive thinking, and just remain in God's presence in peace and quiet with simple loving advertence to God. When we do so, God will not fail to communicate with us silently and secretly. That would be less possible than it would be for the sun not to shine or on clear and uncluttered ground. And so when we can hear this language, remaining in God's presence, which is remaining in the presence of things as they are, of just this pure lotus land. We must do our part to free our hearts and minds from inadequate and distorted ideas and concepts about the incomprehensible God, from desires for self-gratification in prayer, and from activities that prevent the peaceful inflow of God's loving presence in our heart. So we must free our minds from inadequate and distorted ideas about enlightenment, about Buddha nature, about zazen, free from desires of self-gratification in practice, in meditation. That's enough, God. And then I'm going to conclude with some quotes from Roko Sherry Shyatt, who's an American Rinzai Zen master. You know, and so it's interesting to me that that we can hear that for me, Soto Zen, the Soto Zen of Dogen, sounds exactly like the perspective from the Rinzai Zen masters, which sounds like the experience of Teresa of Avila, which sounds like the descriptions of Amida's compassion. Enlightenment is not a thing, not a condition, not an event, not a goal, not an accomplishment. That which is without limit cannot be defined. Yet the question is a burning one for Buddhists. Even though we may be too hip to ask it, deep down we want to know, what is it that we are practicing? But in truth, we are practicing enlightenment. It is always and already here. There's not a hair's breadth separation between what we perceive as our separate burdensome selves and Buddha nature. Zen Master Rinzai said, "Followers of the way, it is urgently necessary for you to attain true insight." And then he continued, "Just don't strive." Which is especially fascinating coming from Master Rinzai, who gave his name to the Rinzai school, which looks often from the outside and sometimes to the inside to be the striving school of Zen. And so this points to the fact that our beliefs about these two different ways of practicing, about just sitting versus sitting to attain samadhi, that these are really very different things, that is perhaps a mistaken belief when we look. This non-striving, this is effortless effort, difficult, for it flies in the face of all our conditioning, easy, for it requires nothing but an utter giving up and entering into this unlimited, unbounded moment. The more we sit in this dumbfounded way, the more our hearts and minds are purified. What we think is the obstacle is the very encouragement we need to open, to give unconditionally, to enter with the swiftness of a knife thrust into what has never been hidden. And then Roko says, this is koan practice. So, that's some entryways, hopefully, into your own faith, your own intimate presence with your lives. Thank you for your patience and attention.